This is a Pinball News production.
First of all, about a month ago, Steve wasn't sure if he could make it. Somehow he's here. And by the way, he'll be 97 in December. That's it. Also, when I spoke to Wayne, I don't know, I'll be 90 this year. I don't know if I could do it again. And already he's giving me problems about coming next year. Can you believe that? But anyways, we're tickled to have them both here. True living legends in the industry, Wayne with D. Gottlieb and Steve with Genko, Bally, and Williams. And they're here just to chat about their life and, of course, take questions from you about how it's been for them in the industry and what they're up to now. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I bring to you Steve and Wayne. Guys?
Thank you.
Nobody can be that old. I'll tell you what, Wayne, you begin. You start telling them a story about yourself.
Well, I don't know.
And then I guess the mic is working.
Is it? Can everybody hear? Yeah. Well, I've known Steve for a long, long time, but not as a friendly person. We were kind of in competition for so many years, and never really met. And only at shows we'd pass each other on the aisle, but never friendly. But once we both got retired, well, we became good friends and he's quite a guy, and he came down to see me down in Arkansas. His brother lives in Mountain Home, Arkansas, which is very strange here. A little town like that so far away, and his brother lives there. And so Steve came down, and I told him, when you're down seeing your brother, for heaven's sake, give me a call and come on over, and we'll have lunch together. So a couple of winters ago, it was around Christmas time, I think he came down to see your brother at Christmas. He calls me up and says, hey, I'm coming over for lunch. And I said, hey, Steve, I don't know about that. My wife's pretty sick, and I'm the cook. And if you come over for lunch, you're going to have to eat my cooking. And he said, that's all right. I'll come over. So he came over, and we did. We had a great time talking. And then I made lunch for him. And by golly, he sat there and ate it all up. And anybody that can eat my cooking, I got respect for him. I got a lot of respect for that gentleman. And over the years, we've remained friends, and I wish he could get down more often, and when he gets here, come over and see me. But he's quite a guy. And Norm Clark is here. I think you all seen Norm over there. I think that Norm and Steve here have been in the business for so long and done so much, and particularly Steve here, who is 97 years old and came over here for this morning, and I think that's just fantastic, and I'm real proud of him having come, and I think we ought to give him a standing ovation, both of them, both Norm Clark and Steve here. I just wish Norm could get up here on the stage here and sit with us, but it's a little difficult for him. We could wheel him up here, though, a little bit. Maybe we're a little closer where you could see him. Why don't you come up a little closer, Norm? Can't you get up a little closer here where you can sit down in front with us?
Sure, sit down over here.
Yeah, come down here where we all see you. Norm has been in the business, I don't know, maybe as long as I have. I started in the business back in... In 36, I started in 36 in February, and Steve here, he's a young man. He didn't start till the fall of 36. I think in August, September, as I recall, huh? September?
April 97.
What year?
April 97.
April 97. Oh, he's just a kid, you see, but he started at Genko, and I started at Western, and we. We came up through the ranks. He started as he soldered on the line, as I recall, and I started as a draftsman, still in high school, And that's the way we started, and then we slowly learned the business and finally got into designing, and the rest is history. So we got quite a pair here, and I got a lot of respect for this gentleman, and he made a lot of good games. Not as good as mine, but he made some pretty good ones. I like to say that, you know, he did some pretty good designing, I have to admit. And, you know, they used to bring all their games into our showroom, into my office, into my design room, and I was always told to look at those games and get some ideas. And I said, I'm not going to look at any of those games from that guy over there, because he's too good. And if I look at his ideas, I'm going to start following him, and I want to just stay on my own. But we used to look at all the company's games, and particularly Williams, because they were great. They were a great company, and Harry Mabbs over there, and he was great. Someone said today that they didn't realize that Harry Mabbs made the flipper, and I thought that was very strange. I thought everybody knew that. Anyway, want to carry on a little bit? I'll give my voice a rest.
Okay, give him a rest and I'll start. First of all, I'd like to ask, how many of you here, raise your hands, that are here for the first time?
Oh my goodness.
My That's goodness. Holy mackerel.
That is amazing.
Well, you don't know us. You don't know my background. You should hear some of it, and you're going to get very excited to know just exactly how I got started in this industry. It's very exciting. First of all, let me tell you that I graduated from high school in 1930, started college with electrical background, and during the Depression, I had to quit. My mother and father, I was one of eight children at the time, trying to make a living. Mom worked nights occasionally. My father worked 2 days a week trying to pay interest on the house and paying the bills. I had to quit college and go to work. And when I got a job, I was sure glad to make 10 cents an hour, a dollar for an all-day job. That is where I learned. Everybody asks me what I remember about my background. The best thing I remember in my background is I learned what it meant to make a buck. And I'll tell you, it was very exciting. Anyway, got to a point where I got into the CCCs. Do you know what the CCCs are? The Civilian Conservation Corps. They sent me to Idaho. Yes, big sent me to Idaho because when I was there, I was paid $5 a month for excitement, and $25 a month was sent to my mother and father to help take care of their living expenses, which worked out very good. I then got through with the CCCs, joined the Forest Service, worked in a ranger station, was a dispatcher, took care of fires in Idaho, and it was a very exciting experience. And when I was leaving, they decided to give me a contract that I would come back to work with the Forest Service, wanted to send me to Missoula, Montana, to the university, give me a Forest Service background, and so that I would stay in Idaho. I had no intention of wanting to live in away from my family in Chicago with all my brothers and sisters and mother and father, so I came home for this summer, for the winter of 1936. I wanted so badly to stay in Chicago that I went to church every day looking so that I would pray that I could find a job. Nobody could get a job. One day in 1937, April, I was walking down the street at Ashland Avenue, and it rained like all blazes. I had no umbrella, so I opened up the door to a factory to get in, get out of the rain, and the woman opens the window in the rain. She said, "Are you looking for a job?" Good Lord, I was looking for a job all day, and here she asked me if I want to work. "Can you solder?" I sure as hell can solder. With a little background, electrical background that I had, what happened is they put me on a soldering line. It wasn't long before I was so close to the people that were testing the games, and since I got to know the games very well, I could find very fast what was wrong with them when they were being repaired. And when the people that were testing it, I could get a chance sometimes to, during recess, to come over and show them what was problems. It wasn't long that the engineering department says, this guy doesn't belong on the soldering line. We need a guy in engineering. Then I got acquainted with a man named Harvey Heiss. That's a story in itself. And I hope that next year, Rob can tell you or show you a film between Harvey Heiss and myself that's almost unbelievable. It's from him after starting in 1937 and up to 1958, I learned more from Harvey Heiss on how to build games, why I should build the kind of games that I should build, how to satisfy the public, and it was something that I learned, kept me for the rest of my life, and helped me in the industry. During this same period, in 1947, Harvey Heiss got sick. And here we had a big show in 1948 in one of our big hotels in Chicago. And the pin game show was coming on. And on December, the company came over to me. Harvey's in the hospital, can't make a game. Will you please sit down and build a game? I never built a game in my life. This is the first time. So what happened is, in 1 month's time, I built a game called Triple Action. And what happened is, the reason I called it Triple Action is because I had a triple feature on a game. But what's most important is I copied the idea of flippers. And at that time, 3 months earlier, Gottlieb with Harry Mabbs came out with the Humpty Dumpty with the six flippers, two on the top, two in the middle, and two on the side. I was brought up by Harvey Heiss to be very conservative in building something, so I never put six flippers on my game. I put two flippers at the bottom of the game in the center. And when that game came to the show, Triple Action, it took the goddamn game, the show by storm. We sold so many games that the company never sold that many at that time. And it was since that time, that's where the flippers have been at the bottom of the game. And that's something I enjoy having done. Anyway, I finally got a chance to leave Genko because they folded up, went to Bally for a couple of months, and then I went to 1960 with Harry Williams to start working there. And you want to know that, just remember that when I was in 1937, there were about 15 companies, regular companies, building pin games. Full time. And in the early 30s, when the games were being sold for $16 or $14 and took only one penny, there were about 100 different outfits all over the country who tried to get into the industry, would occasionally build a game. But the reason they wanted to get into the game is because the regular companies, the big companies, when they put out the games for $15, $14, you would go out and buy it, put in for one penny, and over a weekend you got your money back. So why were the companies making 30, 40, 50,000 games of a run? And everybody wanted to get into the business. The companies that were in it at the time were Genko, Rockola, Gottlieb, and Bally, and others. There's some Stoner, and I can't remember all of them, but there were about 12 of them that were active at that time. Anyway, I came back in 1960 to Williams, and then I have a great, one heck of a time working then, because that's where I got acquainted with Norm Clark. We worked together, put out some great games, I think. And I want to say we had better games than you did. I think we had them just as good. And the things that he knows, like I know, that whenever they came out with a brand new game, we had one of their bottles in our place before they had it on location. And they did the same thing to us. They had a game in their place before Palm Beach. We could get a game on a location. And that was a method that we used in those days to find out what competitors were doing. It was very exciting. It was very interesting and very good. And in the meantime, as Rob mentioned, this December 26th is my birthday. That's when I'm going to be 97. Good Lord willing, I hope I make it for the 25th, because I made it for all 24 so far. I hope so. I had my experiences the last 2 months. Was very sick, stayed in bed for a while, and I'm still having a little trouble walking, but we'll make it. In the meantime, I'm sure that Wayne's got more to say besides what I've been talking about.
Oh, I got my own mic. Yeah, well, that's a very interesting story, and of course, all these new people here, that's really interesting and entertaining to them, because they haven't heard that story before, and that's really great. I'd like to say a little bit about some of the big people in this industry. Seeing we have so many new people here, I'm sure they don't know some of the history of our industry, we had, in this little industry, which is so small, we had two United States senators. Homer Capehart was the first senator, and he ran a jukebox company. Wurlitzer or...
Packard.
Yeah, and anyway, he was a senator, and he was a good friend of Dave's, and he would come in the office once in a while with his big cigar and sit down with him and Dave, both smoke cigars, and they sit there and talk, and they were really good friends, and I got to know Homer pretty well. And then we had Ed Zarensky from Omaha, who became his father was a distributor in Omaha, and he became a United States Senator, and he was much younger. He was Elvin's age, Elvin Gottlieb. It's too bad Elvin isn't here today, but Elvin's been having a little medical trouble and wasn't able to make it, but he and Elvin were friends, and when his dad would come to Chicago, Ed would come with him, and they'd pal around. They'd come in the engineering room and in my design room and fool around, play around, and they were 10 and 12 years old, and they were a lot of fun, of course. And anyway, he grew up and became a United States Senator, which is really something. And one thing I forgot about Capehart, he introduced a bill to make the Air Force Academy, and which is a big factor. And who knew that later on in life that one of my granddaughters, graduated from the Air Force Academy. And her husband also graduated from the Air Force Academy and became a fighter pilot over in Iraq, which is so interesting. Now, and another very famous person that I'm sure you've all heard about is Warren Buffett, the rich millionaire from Omaha. He got started in pinball machines. He started operating games while he was in high school. And when he sold his route, that's when he went into the other businesses of his. And he made so much money, he must have been operating Gottlieb games, don't you think? Of course, maybe one or two Williams, but mostly Gottlieb games. So that's a little history of some of the big people in this industry, and we should be very proud of them.
Wayne, can you share some of the excitement when the flipper was developed and was introduced?
Well, we were all very excited about it, of course, and it came out. Harry Mabbs made the first flipper, and I was standing there when he operated the first flipper. I used to help Harry a lot turning the crank for him. Harry Mabbs was a big idea man. He had ideas flowing all the time. He had more ideas than he knew what to do with, and so he always needed a helper to draw the circuit or do the wiring or whatever. His idea was at the time was he had built a ramp that came down the right side of the board, and he put a switch in the board, and then it went across the flipper. So it would, come down and automatically kick the ball, what he was going to do. And but he had it in his hand, he had the wires in his hand, he press it and he kick it by hand, which he said, gee, that's pretty good, and, you know, and he kept fooling around with that, and so I tried it, and I go, yeah, that's fine, Harry, and so he used it and put it in a game and called it the flipper. And of course, the first game he made had six flippers, as Steve mentioned, and then of course he came along, he made one of these cheap games, he only put two flippers in the game. But golly, we had six flippers in the first game, and we made the game up and we called it flipper. And it was almost ready for production, and we finally made it to Humpty Dumpty and had to make some changes in it, one thing or another. But at the same time, Nudgee came out. Maybe nobody ever heard of Nudgee. I don't know. There's one anybody here. Heard of Nudgee?
There's one here.
There is? Anyway, Nudgee came out, and we were sitting around the lunchroom table discussing things one day, and somebody, some salesman came in and said, "Oh, there's a player-controlled game out in California," and we all looked at each other, scared to death. You know, we thought, "Oh man, somebody let the cat out of the bag." See, so they sent Elvin out to California to check the game out, and he called up one afternoon and said that he saw the game and it was a Nudgee. You just had to push it and the board would move back and forth in the cabinet. And so we were very relieved and we put the Humpty Dumpty out, and of course that was history. And one interesting sidelight at that time when everybody was putting on flippers except United Manufacturing Company.
They were late.
Lynn Durant says, "I'll never put a flipper on a game. And it don't belong on a game," and he wouldn't do it. So that lasted about maybe a month or 2 months.
Yeah, three months later.
3 months, and he couldn't sell a game anymore, so he finally put a flipper on. But at that time, it was interesting, in the industry out in the field, people would take and buy flipper kits. We sold kits.
More kits than the games.
Yeah, we sold kits by the thousands. For and flippers. People would add them on their game where they thought would be a
old
good
games.
Spot and make a new game out of it. Because every location wanted flipper games, and that was it.
Those are the days you couldn't build a game without flippers. You couldn't sell it, you couldn't buy it, you wouldn't play it. So consequently, what happened is operators that had dozens of games that had no flippers on them decided to buy these little what do they call them? They were little packages that they put them on the games. I know it every so often. I go to a show and I see a game that I built in 1930, 40 or something, and never had a flipper on. If all of a sudden I see it with flippers, I said, "I never put flippers on that doggone thing." It's exciting to know that.
Flippers really made this industry. There's no question about it. Harry Mapps came up with the greatest idea that it made an amusement game out of a gambling game. And up until that time, everybody thought nothing but gambling, knockoff buttons, and so forth. And now I have to give credit to Williams. They were the first ones to take the knockoff button off the games.
Yeah.
I think you were probably there about the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I was there.
How did that decision come about?
Well, it's an inside job. Anyway, the thing. Anyway, what happened is, there were two companies that were never in existence during the 30s and the early 40s. That's United and Williams. How were they founded? Lynn Durant and Harry Williams got together. They got together in 42 or 43 to build games. It wasn't long when after about a year together they decided that since they were chasing around with the same gang babes, they had better separate. So what happened is they tossed a coin up to see who would stay with Boulogne and who would leave, and Williams lost. So United with Lynn Durant stayed under the name United, And then Harry Williams stayed with his name, Williams Games, and he built the first game in 1945 called Suspense. And I bought a 1945 Suspense game about 10 years ago, a prime game. It was in absolutely prime condition. It was in the basement of some woman who said, get that goddamn thing out of my place. My kids left me, nobody's playing it, take it. I got it. And I unloaded it to somebody that, a good friend of mine that likes pin games. I don't have any more games. I had games. I had dozens of games, but I unloaded them, sold them, made good money, and I still have a couple left, but that's about all. But I don't make a big collection of games. I worry I let somebody else have that. It's always fun to know that we can have fun. Anyway, I just want you to know that when I started working at Williams, when I was first working at Bally, and then when I got a notice from somebody that Williams was looking for somebody to work in his place, I did come there and started working in 1960, and Harry Mabbs was there, the original designer of the six flippers at Gottlieb. Well, he at that time was kind of a little over the hill and had trouble designing games by himself, as you always knew. And I was helping him finish his last game, and then he retired into Florida, Hollywood, Florida. And there was a Hollywood in Florida. And I visited him there several times, and I think that's the way it worked out. Otherwise, everything turned out very good for me. I had one hell of a time and stayed with Williams. I stayed in the industry from 1937 to 1998, 61 years. And then call it quits. Having been fun, I had a little too much fun. Had a great time, I just want you to know that I don't think there's anything more that I can say that the people that I associated with and worked with and had fun with were very, very important to me in my life, which included Norm Clark. And of course, we had one heck of a time. And it was one of these things that you can only talk sometimes in the background about, because the excitement of those years meant coming to work. It meant that you got up in the morning and said, oh, I gotta go to work today, I'm going to work. You know, I always said that if I went halfway to work and I thought I wasn't gonna enjoy it, I'd have turned around and gone home and quit. But I never did it. Ever came back, because there's always something exciting. There's always something new, something different. And when I made the two flippers at the bottom of the game, that was something I'll never forget. Then, of course, when I got with Williams, I made the first game and patented what made the first drop target. First drop target I ever had was on a game that I made. Then I made also patented a circular deal that when you hit it, it turns 90 degrees to a different value. That was another patent that I had on that too. Yes, sir.
What was the inspiration for the drop target?
I don't know what happens. You peak building means you got targets all the time, right? Oh, we had targets all the time. And I said, gee, well, what happened if I lost that son of a gun? So what happened is you'd lose it, but then the values of that particular target would go up, and now you wanted to get something. That's what made it exciting. So after that, Gottlieb got into the thing, and boy, when they started building them in four, five, and dozen series, I couldn't believe they made them so big, for crying out loud. They were terrific games. Some of their card games were unbelievable, unbelievable. Of course, I don't think you had anything to do with them because they were that good. They were unbelievable games, and we enjoyed playing them. I'm sure they enjoyed playing our games too. Yes, sir.
When you were at Genco, Genco was a major industry, a major member of the industry at the time. What in the world prompted the company to close at the zenith of the industry?
Well, let me tell you what happened. Genco, when I started, were three brothers that owned it. Lou, Dave, and Meyer Gensberg. Not Gensberg, Gensberg. That's why the game was called Genco, not Genco. It was Genco after the Gensberg brothers. Anyway, what happened is Dave was the one that actually was doing the following through on the games. Lou, he was one of these guys that have fun coming to the work. And then Meyer was very good, interested in knowing what was being done on the line. He followed everything on the line. Well, we had unbelievable experiences. What happened is the Gensberg brothers at that time in the 30s were buying up all real estate properties in the north side of Chicago on corners where there was a store, second apartment and above, and they kept buying all these papers for the money they were making. I remember one time I came to the office and Miss Gentron had a pile of about 12 inches high of taxes that she was paying on this property. They made so much money that they, in conjunction with another group of people, opened up the first high-rise hotel in Las Vegas. First ones to ever build a high-rise one. What happened is the Gensberg brothers decided they wanted to run it. Well, they were running it, and they were losing their butts because they had all the gambling down in their basement area. They couldn't make a buck. Of course, they couldn't make a buck because they didn't join the proper people. So they finally sold them to the proper people and got $100,000 a year just as a rental for it. And then that's how I got to know about the place. And what happened is when they left, they left the business to their the son-in-law of one of them and the son-in-law of the Mr. From Chicago Coin, I forget his name. Anyway, they took over the business. And when you have two college graduates trying to run a business and telling you how to run the business and changing everything you're doing and you're trying, even when you'd have a guy that had a little color background in his college experience, he never was satisfied with the color of the cabinet. You change a color cabinet, change a cabinet. Well, we got to a position where we were losing business. When they took over the business from the Gensbergs themselves, they had over $500,000 in assets. Well, it wasn't long before that was gone. When that was gone, we weren't making any money. The company had to call it quits. So that when they quit, I had an opportunity with three other people in the industry who were very, very important to me at the time. It was an electrical man, a mechanical man, and one that took care of the games down the line. And I had nowhere to go with them. I could get a job with Notre Barral. Wayne Nyans from United called me, and he knew that we quit, offered me an unbelievable job to come there and work as a pin game designer. And I said, well, I'll come if you'll take the four of us. No, he won't. He won't take me. I couldn't get anybody. I went to Seberg. And I went to Seberg because we were also making good guns at that time. Good guns, rifle guns. And at that time, Seberg had just burned 1,000 gun games in their backyard. Why? Seberg at that time, I just want to tell you why I came to Seberg, because I thought, well, I wanted to sell my idea with the guys so we would help them. They, at that time, they built a game the big we were accustomed building a game that used to move and used to shoot at them with a rifle. They build a game. They call it Coon Hunt. Now, can you imagine selling Coon Hunt in the South? My goodness, they had a raccoon running up and down, and they called it a Coon Hunt. They couldn't sell the goddamn games, so they had to burn them. So when I came there, I got to see the chairman of the office, and I says, oh, yeah, we have a good background in gun games. We make good games. They're selling. How about hiring us? They took us under advisement. They had a meeting in their board of directors. They said, nah, they don't want to take any more chances on that. So where the hell am I going to go with these four guys, four of us? I went to a good friend of mine at Bally, Bill O'Donnell. He says, Bill, I got a problem. He was one that was running Bally at the time, if you people know. What do you got? I said, I got four guys. Everybody wants to hire me because I have pin game background, experience and background, but they all want to take only me. I'll take all four of you. Can you imagine that? It took me all four of us, and we got into the place, we started building some guns for them, and we did a hell of a job for them. Then it was the next year when by background notice, nobody comes directly from a company, says they would like to have you, you know. Hey, listen, call Sam Stern. He's looking for a designer, you know. He's looking for a designer. So I called him. He made me an unbelievable offer, so I said, I got to do something about this. I went back to Lynn Duran. I got a problem. You got another problem? Yeah. I got a job for Penn Games. I like to leave because I got a good job, get a lot more money than I'm getting here. He says, very good. I want you to promise one thing. Don't ever take any one of these three guys out of here that you took. Every one of them finished working at Bally. Every one of them retired from Bally, made good money, so they were very important people in their background. So that's how I got involved with the two companies and then with Williams and Willett. And when I started with Williams, I had one hell of a time. When I started with Genco, I had a great time. And the reason I had a good time at Genco, because I figured when they put me in engineering, is I had an electrical background. And at that time, games were being played with batteries, with C batteries. Do you know what C batteries are? They're about 4 or 5 inches wide and about 10 inches long. That's what they're, then when they'd stink up the place, when they'd go out, you know, then we were, at that time in 1936 and 37, we were changing games from that to electrical power. Would you believe that in those days, operators would say, where the hell are we going to plug these games? Yeah, they had no plug outlets anywhere for games. Plug them into the lights, the fixtures, and set up. So it worked out all right. It all worked out good. That's a little background of my background. I can talk, but I don't want to talk too long. I'm taking too much time. Go ahead, you get it.
That's all right. You just keep on going. I don't have to talk when you're talking. I can just sit here and listen and enjoy it, too. But you talk about battery-operated games. When I came into business, they've just gotten through using batteries. They started putting power packs in. And of course, all the operators, they were scared to death to touch the game when they had a power pack in it.
Didn't know where to plug them.
They didn't know what to do with them, but it scared everybody. And then we had a lot of rebuilding of the games. They'd bring in a battery-operated game, and we'd put a power pack in and hook it up. And us kids who were only 17, a lot of young people working in those days, probably still today, but we were all young, and we would fight to get the opportunity to repair these games, put the power pack in, because when you'd open them up, there's always nickels in there. And when you're working for 30 cents an hour, you know, and you find 10, 15 nickels and they lay in the back of a game, you had it made. So you do two or three games a day, boy, you had a good day. But that power pack didn't last too long. There was a lot of problems with that that DC DC circuits and.
That's right.
Pardon?
Yeah, we had one hell of a time.
Oh yeah, that was a great
all
time.
All right, we have about 15 more minutes left. We'd like to start taking questions from the body and so about something.
Yeah. Hey, so you tell us briefly about Norm and some of Norm's experience with Williams.
What about?
Well, just so give.
Well, Norm and I. Well, there was a time Norm Clark, when I started working there, was in engineering and design and whatnot. What he was to do is take care of the games for production and set them up for production with his team, and worked out very good. Then when it came upon a time when they needed some get me some help, because I was the only one making these damn games, for crying out loud. In 1960, I built the. 9 games by myself, 10 games in 1 year by myself. And it got to a point where I couldn't keep doing that all myself, so they asked if I'd take Norm Clark with me. And I says, hell yes, I'll take anybody. And Norm Clark turned out very, very good, because he and I teamed up, and we got to be so doggone good that there were times, and I know he would like to talk about it, but he'd probably be hard to explain to you why. He and I always used to go out to lunch together. Well, when Harry Williams used to have people with special dinners ready for us to eat, everybody, but we'd say, the hell with it, we got to get out of this place. So we'd always go out to lunch. He'd say, see that, look, we got pork chops to eat over here. These two guys are walking out, going out to eat. That's what happened. But anyway, yes, sir.
Steve, when you were at Valley, did you ever have any dealings with the Bingos?
Well, I was there, they were making Bingos, but I was working in a special department where they were making just a gun game that was with Breitenstein at the time. And I don't, to this day, I say to myself, I wish I'd maybe had stayed with them, because, although I had a hell of a time with Williams, because 2 months after I left, Breitenstein retired. And they had to get somebody else to take his place, and I could have taken that place because I was doing everything for him, you know.
Did you know that Breitenstein had a brother?
No, I didn't know he had a brother.
He had a brother. He worked at Western.
Oh, is that right?
He was he drank quite a bit, and he would fall asleep during the day. I remember very much. He worked off in a loft someplace. He had cabinets piled up, and he'd get in behind these cabinets and take a little nap once in a while. He was the black sheep of the family.
Not a bad idea. Yeah. Yes, you were going to say something.
When you and Norm started working together at Williams in 1966, when I believe Norm designed it, but you guys are on the back glass.
Williams 8-ball.
Oh yes. We sometimes had things on the games that we didn't want to talk about, you know. But with initials in there and everything else, we had in some cases. But it was fun to know that we had it. But the company that we were working for, the people that we were working for, were not necessarily too excited about that. And there was the days that they didn't even want us to put names of our names on the games, you know, like they did later on when all the players decided they wanted their name on there, their designer on there, who helped them with the electrical work, who'd help with the mechanical taste, what year it was and everything else. So that's how the game started coming out.
Was that the first one where it actually kept the players scoring separately for each player?
Oh, you're talking about the time when we came into solid state. That's what you're talking about. We never could without the solid state build a game with two or three players, because you couldn't put enough relays into the game in order to make it operate. So when we started getting solid state, my gosh, we'd take a game and two players or four players, no, was no problem at all. We carried off the features from game to game, from time to time.
Norm, how about telling the story about the 8-ball? That was the carryover for this. It carried over the memory, right, on the 8-ball?
Yeah, I used a spurt bike.
The 8-ball was, that was one of his favorite games. In fact, Norm's first game was Kingpin in 62, which he thinks was a dud game. I thought it was a great game, Kingpin. Steve's first game at Williams is Bobo. And I might agree with you on that. That wasn't one of your better games.
Yep. But I built many games that had space in its theme, particularly Space Mission and Space Odyssey. Those were two of the great games. Each one had over 10,000 games built, 16,000 on Space Mission, and then Grand Prix immediately after that, 12,000. So we did pretty well. We can't complain. And the games that Norm Clark was building, particularly Go-Go, was an unbelievable game. And there were so many games that he built that it's almost unbelievable. And in fact, I have a list of them over here right now. If you want to know what he built, I'll tell you.
Steve, do you remember the story about Miss Q?
Oh, yes.
Story about what?
We built a game called Miss Q. Called it Miss Q. When it went to France, they almost died. Because because in French, Miss Q related to some private parts of a woman. And they said, you can't call a game Miss Q. So we had to change the game. We could change it to Miss O. Yeah, that's an exciting background. That's something.
Miss Q meant ass in French.
Yeah. Wait, how did you get a shot at designing when Harry Mabbs was still at the company?
I was working in the engineering room, and I was building test fixtures. And I had to build test fixtures for every game that came along. And that was my job. And when I finished building the test fixtures for a game, which I hurried up and figured out how to do it real quick and get them done, then I'd take a cabinet and I took a blank board and I just was playing around. Instead of wasting time like a lot of people did at wherever you worked, everybody wastes time when they don't want to kill the job, you know. So, but anyway, I would add a little bit to the game and I'd work on it and I worked on it. It took probably a year before I got the game designed, and they liked it. Everybody liked it, and we went into production on it. And then I started on another game, and again, it took maybe a year or so to make it. And in the meantime, Harry Mabbs was designing games, and we were going right along. And so that's where I got started designing, just instead of wasting time, I was fooling around making a game, just to amuse myself, probably more than anything. And I came with the first game. We did real well in that first game. College Days did very well for that time. I think we built about 2,500 or something like that. And then, of course, Harry ended up going to Williams. And when he left, Dave came to me and said, Wayne, the job is yours. And I moved my toolbox into Harry's office, and I was on my own from then on. And I designed for about 15 years and made over 100 games, 150 games per year. I made the four-player game, and I made the add-a-ball game. Each one was different, and it added to our games that we built. We have four-player, two-player, add-a-ball, and single players, one right after the other. And that was really, we really had a great time during those years. When you make a four-player game and then stop for 3 or 4 months building other games, well, there was a big demand for a four-player when you came back into it. Yes, sir.
When you built Queen of Hearts, you loved that game so much that you were stalled on ideas.
I certainly was, yes. For a long time after Queen of Hearts, I loved that game. I still, to this day, I love that game. I think it was I think it's the best game I ever built. And I had an awful time designing anything after that. For about 2 or 3 months, I couldn't come up with anything. I just was stymied. I didn't know what to do. Nothing could beat that game. I thought that was the end of all games, and it was a great game. And then of course, once I got out of my system and got on to other things, then everything was great again. But that Queen of Hearts was. A lot of people think that there are other games that are better, but I don't know. I still think that's the best game.
Yes, sir.
In the early days, were there royalties or bonuses offered or incentives to build a better game?
Oh, no. That was our business. We did that, and
got paid a salary just like everybody else.
That's right. In my case, and it was very good for me, because what happened, they would give you a bonus every month for, you know, at the end of the month. Instead of a check, you got a check with a bonus. So they would try to express their appreciation for what you did. They would increase the bonus. That was the only way I was satisfied with. It worked out very good. There's other things that worked out very good too, but I want to talk about it right now.
You know, back in 1937, free plays was unknown. Nobody knew what a free play was.
That's right.
And everything was gambling. You had your seven horses and your win place show and purse, and everything was a takeoff of that. And so Jimmy Johnson bought the first free play coin chute. Somebody came in with it, and it was just a push chute. And a lever on the bottom, and it had a solenoid, a magnet on the bottom, and it would pull in and would allow you to push the chute in without a coin. And that was what they called the free play coin chute. But they didn't know what to do with it. All the engineers were, designers were all thinking of gambling. And so they needed a free play unit, or they needed something to use to whatever, you know. And they didn't know what to make, and so I ended up making the first free play unit that was ever made. And I put it in the game and showed it to Jimmy Johnson, and he called in the company that built our step switches, and they came in and looked at it, and they gave me $50 to sign off all rights to the free play unit. And that was the first free play unit that was ever made. I made it back in 37.
What was the game?
There was no game. It was just a free play unit. You mean with the game I put it in?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know what it was. Some old game laying around the shop. That it was just, you know, it was just, there was games laying all over the place. And whenever you needed one, you'd pick up a game and work on it.
Yeah. Okay, Jess, Sam, go ahead.
Wayne, but give you the incentive to come up with a double game where you would put a second coin in, and if you won games, you got double, and sort of skirted the issue of gambling.
Well, that was just a desperate thing to do, and I one day I was playing a game, and I felt hot, you know, I couldn't lose, and I said, man, you know, if I just put a second coin in, I get double, you know, and that would be great, and I thought, gee, maybe it would work in a game, and so I put it in the first game, and then we used it for maybe, three or four games, I think it was, and then we took it out, because it really was a lousy feature. We put a lot of lousy features in games, and we'd put them in and leave them in for a game or two, and then we'd take them out. And it'd be...
We never put lousy games.
Anybody else?
Tell people that are here for the first time. Tell them about your Spirit of 76.
Oh, Spirit of 76? Oh, well, I guess, I suppose that's a pretty good story.
Yeah.
At Gottlieb, we used to sit around a dinner table and have our dinner, have our lunch, and we never went out for lunch, not like over at Williams. You used to go out for lunch once in a while, didn't you?
We always went out to lunch.
Goof off they'd goof off and not come back to work right away, but... But Dave wouldn't let us out of the shop. See, he thought we probably wouldn't come back, and so he kept us there by having a great lunch when we had a great cook, and she fed us well, and probably too well.
Well, tell them the reason why they wouldn't let you go out. They didn't want you to associate with anybody.
Well, we didn't want to associate with the lower class that over at Williams. Yeah.
That's exactly the reason they wouldn't let you out.
Yeah. But anyway. We were getting ready to build Spirit of 76, and we were all, Judd Weinberg was in charge of the company at the time, and so he was taking opinions of the guys around the table, and each one gave a number, and some would say 2,800 would build, and 3,000, 1,500, they're all over the field, and I didn't say anything, so Judd says to me, Wayne, what do you say? You don't say nothing. You just keep quiet. And I said, well, if I told you how many games we're going to build, you'd just all laugh, and that'd be terrible. So he said, oh, go ahead. No, we won't laugh. And I said, okay, 10,000. And everybody laughed. And I said, well, now there you go. And Judd says, well, I'll tell you what I'll do, Wayne. If we build 10,000 games, that 10,000 game is yours. I'm going to deliver it to your house, and it's yours to keep. And when we built the 10,000 game, he loaded it on the truck and shipped it over to my house. And to this day, I still have the game. And Phoebe was down visiting me a short time ago, and her husband, and they played the game. And of course, he tried to beat the high score. And Michael Shaloub from Australia had the high score for several years. And he came down and played and got the high score. And I couldn't beat it, but finally I beat it. And then I emailed him. I said, "Hey, Michael, you got to come back because I got the high score in the game now." And I still got it, and the game works as good as a brand new game because I keep it up. I rebuild the units once in a while and put new rubbers on it and keep it working in pretty good shape. You'd think it was a brand new game. And, I don't know what I'll do with it eventually, but I'd like to give it to somebody or put it in a museum someplace because I don't want it to be lost. We started out numbering the games at 3,000. And this particular game has got a serial number 13,000 on it, so it's authenticated that it's really the 10,000th game. Yeah. That was a great game, by the way. We made, I think, close to 15,000 with a two-player we built with it. It's the only game that I can recall where the same playboard was used in two games, and a two-player and a four-player. And we did that because it was such a great game. And you know, I knew why that we were going to build 10,000 games. I had a feeling for it because I knew, and it was a bicentennial year, 76, and I said every location in the country is going to want one. If it's all red, white, and blue, they're going to have a game. There's no question about this. And so we made a particularly good game, and the colors were beautiful. You can't beat red, white, and blue. I don't care what colors you pick. And it was sensational, and everybody wanted one, and we just knocked the dickens out of that game. Yes, sir?
Why did you start numbering them at 3,000?
Well, to confuse the all the collectors. Well, yeah. We wondered. Yes, sir?
I may be mistaken, but wasn't there an ad at 13 called New York that a small volume was made?
Yes. Yes.
For the... celebrate the repeal of the New York law that says you can't have pinball machines. Was there not a limited production of a game called New York? Basically,
not that I know.
I don't believe we ever made a game called New York.
Yeah.
Because
I played one.
You did.
It's a two-player add-a-ball.
A two-player add-a-ball? I tell you, I made a game, a six-player one time, and that was something. We called it High Boy. It got as far as we had a screen and had made one game, and I don't know what, I'd sure like to find out where that game went to, but somebody, someplace has got High Boy. Yeah. Well, that was a game. What a circuit that was. Yes?
Wayne, in the later years, Gala Bowling Lanes was a test site for a lot of the later games.
You should ask me, but I don't know. I tell you where they were at.
Yours?
No, sorry. We knew we had one place in Mount Prospect that was a very popular place. Another one on Northwest Highway. We had another place called Farmers. We had a place, and we also had Gottlieb Games there too. So, you got to a point where we in our department knew exactly where. They were testing their games, and I'm sure they knew where we are testing their games. That was the name of the business. When you had two good competitors, you did the job right. You didn't goof around, you know. And as far as the association of us with Gottlieb, we never could. They would never allow anybody from their place to get out often enough so we could get together with them, which was entirely different with other organizations. But that's business. That was a life, and that's the way we lived. So it was all right. It worked out very good. I can't complain.
The one thing I want to share with everyone here, as well as these two gentlemen and Norm, is if you remember in 1985, one of the reasons I did the expo was to recognize my heroes, who were the designers. So at the banquet, we had them all come. Well, actually, earlier on in the show, they spoke. We had a panel discussion. We had Norm, Steve, Wayne, and Harvey Heiss. And in some cases, wasn't the first time you guys really met all together in one forum, in one stage. So for the attendees of that show, and back then we had 100 people, you can imagine that, but for the attendees of that show, it was just, there was just electric in the air, because to have all these guys, and like Wayne often mentioned in several of his talks, you know, the Gallup people didn't associate hardly with anybody. So for him to be in the same stage with Harvey and Steve and Norm, I mean, there was so much excitement just for these guys to be together. And I think it was like an hour and a half seminar, but for me personally, it was just so doggone exciting. By the way, that doggone came from you. That's your, one of your lines, doggone. But anyways, for me, one of the most exciting things at that banquet, it was when Norm, Steve, Wayne, and Harvey came in front of the podium there at the banquet, and we recognized him. And like I said, here we have four guys that designed over 600 games or whatever figure I gave, and everyone just stood up and applauded for them, and it was just a great moment. Any last second questions for them before we go to our next seminar?
Poker Arena for Steve. Find out how exciting it was doing that game.
Poker Arena. Tell them about Poker Arena.
Poker Arena? Wow, what a game. That game is had 10 or 11 carryover features on one game, wide body game. 10 carryover features. What a game, Poker Arena. And I still to this day think, I think that was one game that had more stuff on it than you ever could. You could do that with solid state today and carry it over from player to player, carry it from over from one player to two players to three players to four players. And boy, that was some game. How I came about it, I don't know, but it was one of the last big games that I made. And that, it was a wide body game and it turned out very, very good. I can't complain. My experiences in the past are something that I can't explain either with Harvey, with Norm Clark. I remember the Norm Clark had, he had one office next to me and I was in my office. We used to work together and whenever he'd have a problem, he'd call me, I'd look at his game, try to figure it out. And I'd have a problem, I'd come and he'd come to my place. And then he'd say to me, hey, I was over by Sam Stern's place. And he said to me, here, look what Steve's got on his game. I think you ought to use that. And he says, and so he say, oh yeah, that's nice, that's guys. And I'd come back and I'd say, hey, did you know what I was over there? You told me about your game. He said, he also told me about your game. So we had one hell of an association with Sam Stern. He was terrific. Sam Stern was a great man in the business. No, don't take me. When I say these things, I'm only telling you how we felt at the time. But he was great, and I always have one association with Norm that I'll never forget. It was great. I'm sorry he left and went to Belly, and of course Belly gained by that. But son was doing all right. Otherwise, I have nothing else to say. I sure hope that you guys enjoy this, and if you get see me on the floor, you want to talk to me about some other things, I'll be available. I'm sure so will Wayne. And we can talk about this business from morning to night, about games. If you want to know about games that we build, I've got a whole list of them in my folder here. And if you want to tell what Norm built, I have them in my file here too. So we have had a great time. It was the greatest thing in my life. The next thing to my wife, which was the best thing that happened to me in my life, was this business. I was married. One of the things that happened to me is I married a woman that was 6 years older than I. And that's something that never happened in the days that I was married. And when she found out that I was younger than she was, didn't want to get married. It was something. Anyway, it worked out very, very nicely. I can't complain. My wife is responsible for a lot of things about myself, learned me how to eat, learned me how to take care of myself and how to live. And boy, she told me if I ever pass out first, you better stay going like I did or not, I'm gonna come back and give you trouble. She passed away 5 years ago, and she would be 103 years old now if she had still lived. But that was fun. Women, my wife, my mother, my father, and my family are more important to me than anything else in the world. Family. Family makes a life what is worthwhile. Believe me. See, finish it off, kid.
Rob made me sign a statement I'd be here next year, and I think he's going to hang on to that and throw it back in my face by next year. And so we'll see you all next year. How about that?
Yeah. Huh? Guys, thank you so much. Thank you for coming.
Well, I'll be here next year.